TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Who were the Luddites? Machine smashers of the 19th century? Or members of a fascinating social movement with visionary insights into the unfolding drama of industrialization? You are about to hear the conclusion of a two-part informal talk on the Luddites attended by friends at a TUC tea party. Invited to speak with Ian Boll, an author and activist who taught a course on the Luddites at Stanford University. In part one, he recalled the great European thinkers who came to the defense of the Luddites, such as E.P. Thompson, William Morris, and Lord Byron. Lord Byron gave a speech in support of the Luddites in the House of Lords, opposing the historic decision to instate the death penalty for the smashing of machines. In this program, Ian Boll deals with the contemporary implications of the Luddites. What do the Luddites have to do with indigenous insurgencies, the Redwoods, automobiles, and urban sprawl? He begins with an anecdote from Spain on the impact of technology on community and the power of women. Ian Boll.
There was a very interesting ethnography done, I think it was in Spain, a small village, remote village, in which a European consortium came to put a very large hotel complex, maybe something like that. And the deal was that they said to the villagers, we will give you for the trouble you're going to you know, the disruption and so on, we will pipe water all around your village, reticulated water supply, hot and cold running water. Well, how can you be against that? You know, I mean, okay, so it's nice as a tourist to go and see people gathered round the well and carry it on their heads, maybe, back home. But how can you really? You know, you have to be very careful as a kind of, you know, as a northerner going to the third world and saying, no cars for you, you know, carry your water. Well, what actually happened? It's very interesting. What happened was it turned out that the square where the washing went on and where the water was collected was a space of counter-hegemony to the male control of the village. This was a space which was, in a sense, controlled by women counter-hegemonically. It was a space of resistance. It was a material space of resistance. What happened when the water came in was, of course, that they became dispersed and atomized, if you like, in their homes, which, of course, is the fate of the household in industrialized modernity anyway. That is to say, the household has moved from being a site of production to a site of consumption. And that's, you know, a very deep and problematic movement in terms of political movements and community and so on. But who would have thought that this would be the consequence of what one might regard as one of the most benign technologies you could imagine? So in that sense, what we can say is that technics is equivalent to legislation. In fact, it is legislation. It's well known that Moses had the bridges on Long Island built too low for the buses to get to the beaches that would carry people who had to get to beaches in buses and not cars. Now, that is an apartheid. That is apartheid by artifact, right? A bridge is an artifact. You can build bridges up or, you know, high or low. It's equivalent to legislating who can or cannot go to the beaches in a kind of loose kind of way. And that is true of the entire built world and of all technical systems. So this gets us to a very, very difficult point in which what we need in a kind of, I believe, in the spirit of Luddism, is to ask ourselves all the time, what are the effects, what are the likely effects of any particular new technology? And the answer, of course, we can't know the full effect. So that immediately makes it important that perhaps we introduce things provisionally, as indeed the Amish did, for example. That we can go back, we can undo. But of course, some of the infrastructure is extremely hard to undo. It's very, very hard to imagine how we can undo the suburbanization that has happened since the Second World War. Maybe it's too costly. And of course, the effects of suburbanization on the lived experience have been profound. There was a debate about the highway system in the mid-50s. The superhighway. What will be the effects of the superhighway? And they comprehensively missed in that debate every important effect of the highway system, namely gridlock, pollution, the shattering of the inner cities, all the dire effects of automobilism. A study coming out of Heidelberg shows that there simply is no way to use cars sensitively. Let me give you a statistic here. The Environment and Forecasting Institute in Heidelberg, their study, what they did was a kind of cradle-to-grave analysis of the pollution effects of the automobile. They took an average German automobile. And of course, this is Germany where the regulations are tight compared with elsewhere. So they take a car that typically would give you 13,000 kilometers for every year over 10 years, lifetime of a car. Now, each car produces 25,000 kilos of waste and 422 million cubic meters of polluted air. That is just in the extraction of the raw materials alone for the production of each car. Every 50 minutes in Germany, a car is produced that will kill someone. I mean, the figures of the pollution for during the lifetime of the car are even more astonishing. And it turns out when you do a proper social accounting, that's to say capitalism, of course, always externalizes costs if it can. No capitalist is going to put scrubbers on their smokestacks if their competitors are not. They will always externalize. And the social costs, basically it's privatized profits, socialize the costs. The damage and costs of automobilism are absolutely astonishing. It amounts to a vast state subsidy. In fact, $4,000 equivalent per annum for each car in the pollution and so on. That is, of course, socialized. That we bear the cost. We bear the cost of that. In one's discussion and critique of automobilism, however, one must, of course, be fully aware that in this culture in which public space is more or less non-existent, I mean, space is that which is that space which flows around and between capitalist lots. Public space, of course, for half the day is dangerous for example, women. Is it surprising that many women in this culture regard the car as a friend? Of course they do. Why wouldn't they? So we need, again, to attend to the full ensemble of the social relations of production and consumption and distribution in when we look at any particular technology. The important thing about the generalization of Luddism is to, I think, to try to make common cause, not just with those of us who live in, you know, polluted urban situations where we might have a critique of automobilism, but we must make common cause with, for example, I would fold into the Luddite project, if you like, all those native peoples who are resisting development. They seem to me are analogous to the historical Luddites. And one does that by I think, theorizing enclosure. The enclosure movement, of course, was that which Thomas More railed against in the first section of his great book, Utopia, where humans were being thrown off the land for sheep or the new capitalist agriculture. The enclosure movement continues to this day. The Gulf War was at least one of its most important aspects was the recomposition of labor in the Middle East. And the recomposition of labor is about under, of course, NAFTA or some equivalent, or in a larger sense, the GATT question. The recomposition of labor is about to undergo, I think, an important new moment of intensification. What we're faced with and why an international social movement that would bring together under one head different social movements that would include, for example, those of us in the North fighting against the final eradication of the redwoods, urban people fighting against the automobile, against nuclear power, women struggle against the mechanization of birth, the resistance of native peoples to development. I mean, one must also be very clear that probably the resistance, the Chiapas development, may be fully analogous. I think Edward Thompson would say that it was, to the historical Luddites, that they were in fact smashed and broken. Thompson says that he wrote his Customs in Common as a kind of like a message in a bottle, that the market is regnant and is coming like a typhoon. It may just turn out to be that the globalization of the market and the further penetration of it will not be stopped. But it's a message in a bottle, he says, because there is, in my writings, he says, evidence at least of a different consciousness, of a customary consciousness, that things have been different. Okay, that factory discipline, that clock time, atomized individualism are not necessary ways of life. It could be other. So, for example, it seems to me very useful to connect all those who around the world who have been wounded by technologies and techniques in various ways, the downwinders, we're all downwind, actually, the children in near the freeways who have been cretinized by lead, who eat the flakes of lead off the paint. The paint, we need to see that the paint looks like it does in our culture because of the politics of gloss. I mean, it's serious. We need to make common cause, I think, and in fact to theorize something analogous, if you like, to the proletariat, the international proletariat. One might call it the international injuriat, all those who have been wounded by technology, who should be making common cause against, if you like, what Mumford called the mega machine. In the recent review that I did of Thompson's book on Blake and his student Peter Linebaugh's book on the London Hanged, he has a beautiful meditation, and in fact sort of a long empirical account of the Luddite resistance sort of at the docks to the new sort of work discipline. I can read a little bit here, I think. Linebaugh shows how necessary it is to view crime in terms of the real history of making and taking. He's looking at London, and he says, up the Thames, which was the jugular vein of the British Empire, came either unnourishing hunger suppressants such as tobacco and sugar, or deceiving stimulants such as coffee and tea, while downriver sailed vessels carrying soldiers, marines, convicts, sailors, migrants, gunpowder, cannons, Bibles, and sharp-edged tools. He's addressing a cardinal moment in the long history of enclosure in its myriad forms, including what polite scholarship calls urbanization, itself a result of the seizing of livelihood from the rural poor. In response, the poor took back the means of living. The ruling class called it crime. The story of the Royal Naval Dockyards is exemplary. Since the wages of the shipwrights were sometimes years in arrears, the struggle for livelihood centered on the customary right to take chips, the wood waste which formed an essential part of their ecology in housing, energy, cooking, and furnishings, and made up as much as one half of weekly earnings. Samuel Bentham, Jeremy's smarter brother, who designed the Panopticon, which was this, the great prison that you could survey all the prisoners just from one high chair, as it were. Samuel Bentham dryly noted that the limiting of chips to pieces less than 3 foot long could be carried under one arm explained the architecture around the docks. Stairs were just under 3 foot wide, shutters, cupboards just under 3 foot long. Perhaps as little as 1/6 of the timber entering the yards left it afloat. No, this is the story of enclosures and the resistance to modern utilitarian, you know, the waged economy. It was, of course, in fact, a continuation of, if you like, the Luddite struggle. The rural Luddites, actually, in the 1830s and 40s, who smashed not the power looms but the threshing machines, were actually successful. It was, in fact, put off. They put off agricultural innovation in agricultural techniques for perhaps 70 years. And, of course, there is much more sabotage than one is ever led to believe, if you ever worked in a factory. Or even, you know, the slackers and, you know, the stuff that Process Well does in the kind of these urban factories called offices, which, of course, is the incarceration of headwork, if you like. That happens all the time. And, of course, precisely you do get a customary consciousness residually in the office. It's okay to take, you know, stationery and paper clips and so on. No one's going to... Is it a crime or is it not? Well, sort of yes and no. But the fact is that the sites of resistance are everywhere, but they're often very partial. And it's precisely what needs to happen is for us to try to kind of see the ways in which the residual humanity, if you like, is fostered by this kind of resistance. The deep problem I see is that it's not the case that we can hold out some independent, static view of what it is to be human or a life that is emancipated, as against the, you know, the deadening of the machine and life under this system. The fact is that there is no independent, unhistorical notion of humanity that is not already, as it were, in a dialectical process with the machines. Look, I mean, if it's possible in this culture, which it is, that one of the ways of living is to spend your day in a factory in which you make one movement 120,000 times, shall we say. Let's say it's this. Okay. Now, if you go outside the factory and walk down the street and do this, this is called a stereotopy in psychiatric jargon. This will get you taken inside somewhere and put in another kind of incarcerated place because you're doing this all day. Right? Well, look, the fact is that, you know, those who are condemned to what Frederick Taylor calls sort of the work of, you know, that ox work. I mean, this is a way of living. We are all in that sense. We have all, in, you know, we're not standing outside the machine here. We've all internalized the clock time, right? Thomas Hardy, there's a line from Thomas Hardy where forget where it is now, it might be the mayor of Casterbridge, where there's a line about at a time when one-handed clock sufficiently divided the day. There's a moment in the transition from a consciousness in which you haven't internalized Newtonian clock time, but you do things sort of, as it were, by task. Task-based labor still happens, say, on farms. I mean, anyone who's brought a harvest in, you know that, you know, you work bloody hard for 2 weeks because you have to get it done, you know. And then there's harvest home and you relax for some weeks or however long you can. So that kind of task-based consciousness has nothing whatever to do with the clock as such. Of course it has to do with rhythms. And I don't want even to say that there are natural rhythms, because, of course, we're always already social and cultural. There's no such thing as a kind of a humanity that isn't already cultural. But one can say that there is something vicious about clock time and the work discipline that is imposed by clock time. Your pay is docked for being, you know, N minutes late. Clocks are clearly crucial in the coordination of life as it's arranged in the contemporary situation. But one could imagine a world that is otherwise. But of course, we are no longer we no longer inhabit that world. We have all internalized clock time, and it is actually natural for us. One has to say that. So there's a very dangerous and difficult questions about what technologies are consistent with a natural, healthy way of life. Bakunin's vision, for example, sort of the anarchist, decentralized vision, was a kind of, Bakunin saw technologies, they would all be kind of like Black and Decker technologies. You know, really convivial and friendly, you can pick them up and you drop them, you don't break your toe. But I mean, you know, that no large-scale techniques are possible. There's a kind of technocratic vision of like clean cars and monorails. Illich's critique of that is quite simple. He says, once you have any transportation that goes more than 15 miles an hour, you're going to shatter communities. Anyone who lives on the other side of a road in which there are artifacts of transportation that are moving at more than 15 miles an hour, it's guaranteed. It's simply a necessary consequence of that community will suffer. He claims, anyway, that the first mode of transportation that consistently averaged more than 15 miles an hour was the stagecoach from Paris to Marseille, and that along the line of coach, it was very clear that children were immediately getting killed and so on. And there was no way to repair that. It's the speed alone that does it. And in fact, in my own sort of uncritical celebration of the bicycle, in some of the work I've done, I realized that, and this was thanks to, you know, the critique of roads as such by, say, Earth First, that actually it's the roads that are the disastrous. Once you've got the roads, then it's all lost in terms of the ecosystemically. So then you need a critique of roads. But if you have no roads, where are you? One of the statistics I used to love to give was, you know, that the bicycle is the most beautiful, efficient machine in the universe in terms of how far you can go per calorie, per, you know, gram weight of the person on the bicycle. Well, of course, if you've tried riding on the beach, for example, you know damn well that the bicycle makes no sense unless you see it as a system in connection to the surface that it's on as well. So, you know, if you have a thorough-growing sort of Luddite critique of the roadway, then one's view of the bicycle itself must change. So then you think about intermediate positions of using where the bicycle is, as it is around most of the world, a kind of a beast of burden and utilitarian. I mean, it's not a kind of either a childhood toy or a yuppie leisure machine. Where it's a beast of burden, then you're going to look for roads which will move much more lightly through the landscape, and maybe one does an empirical question whether you can sort of sustain ecosystems and communities on roadways that aren't tarmacadamed and so on like that. So, you know, all the work still needs to be done around any particular technology. And I think that, you know, anyone's sort of activism can be, I think, helped by thinking about it in sort of, you know, Luddite terms. I don't want to sweep everything under the umbrella of Luddism, but the fact is, if we are standing in opposition to what? I mean, to what is it that we are opposed to? And, of course, what is it that we are actually in favor of? I mean, that seems to me at least as urgent, to try to develop, you know, the utopian moment. We just don't have very good models at the moment, it seems to me. The built world, ways of working. It's, and I think, you know, we're moving into even darker times in that sense. So it's all the more important, in a sense, to internationalize this resistance. And one can do it, I think, by taking, and I'll sort of close on this one here, the great lesson of the Luddites was actually that when you look at the historical Luddites, there were different movements under the rubric of General Ludd. They weren't, in fact, it's not true that they were all skilled artisans. They, in fact, contained in the movement other communities that were threatened in different ways by the same historical movement. But they all came together under this great metaphor of the machine. Of course, it wasn't just a metaphor because the power looms were a machine, but the machine, of course, was it also a metaphor. And it seems to me there's a good analogy now between for a kind of, when one needs to think of adequate mythic metaphors in order to mobilize resistance. And I think one that is useful, for example, is the forest. Northern sort of radicals sometimes have a critique of those trying to save the forests of the north of the northwest, who also have started swirling around looking at Amazonia, you know, doing that work of saving the rainforest, saying, you know, what on earth have you in common? You don't have really anything in common with the people of Amazonia. You know, you're privileged, you know, white conservationists. But you don't have to have that in common. Of course one is, you know, we are different from those who get their livelihood from Amazonia. Nevertheless, under the rubric forest, one can, I think, make common cause. Of course we use the forest differently here, but nevertheless it is possible and necessary to connect these two movements in that way. That is to say, they are both, if you're persuaded by my kind of ideas on this, they are both sites of resistance and are moments of the same global enclosure, actually. And one needs to acknowledge in full the differences and the social locations and subjectivities and so on of the forest inhabitants of Amazonia and those of us who are working to, you know, save the wild, such as it, even the enclosed wild in North America. And one can make common cause under the powerful rubric of the forest, which is a metaphor that has enormous, resonant, vivifying power, both for us, but in a completely different way, as it does for those for whom it is a homeland, right?
You heard the second part of a two-part program on the Luddites, a fascinating social movement active in England at the beginning of the so-called Industrial Revolution. This speaker was Ian Ball. He's the editor with James Brook of the anthology Resisting the Virtual Life. This program was recorded by Govinda Dalton and edited and produced by me, Mariah Gallardon. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. Our website is www.tucradio.org. And I want to send a very warm welcome to the listeners of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening.